Audiobook in MP3 of the online book Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald D. Kehoe, 1950. A word about the book by this website's author. In 1950, Donald D. Kehoe wrote an article for True magazine titled The Flying Saucers Are Real. The article was so successful that Kehoe expanded his researches into book length. The result, The Flying Saucers Are Real, was published as a paperback and had as much success as the article. Kehoe wrote several more UFO books, including Flying Saucers, Top Secret, each clearly focused on examining the Air Force cover-up of the most puzzling UFO reports. Kehoe, as founder and director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, campaigned tirelessly to end government secrecy on UFO matters. This book was written more than half a century ago. It contains many of the facts of the UFO phenomenon that are still ignored. The lively tone of the book and the out-of-date vocabulary should not be perceived wrongly, from Ed Ruppelt, later head of Project Blue Book, to Dr. James McDonald, the famous scientist and ufologist. People seriously involved in UFO research all acknowledged that the facts presented in Kehoe's writings are correct, even when they disagreed on his opinion on a U.S. Air Force cover-up of the matter. I note that doubts cast nowadays on the reality of the UFO phenomenon, crackpot witnesses, secret weapon, science fiction-inspired hoaxes, etc., were already addressed by Kehoe. Kehoe worked, others laughed, flying saucers were real, and they still are. If some people chose to work rather than scoff, much credit for that goes to Major Donald D. Kehoe. Chapter 1. It was a strange assignment. I picked up the telegram from my desk and read it a third time. New York, NY, May 9, 1949, have been investigating flying saucer mystery. First tip hinted gigantic hoax to cover up official secret. Believe IT may have been planted to hide real answer. Looks like terrific story. Can you take over Washington End? Ken W. Purdy, editor, True Magazine. I glanced out at the Potomac, recalling the first saucer story. As a pilot, I'd been skeptical of flying discs. Then reports had begun to pour in from Air Force and airline pilots. Apparently alarmed, the Air Force had ordered fighters to pursue the fast-flying saucers. In one mysterious chase, a pilot had been killed, and his death was unexplained. That had been 17 months ago. Since then, the whole flying saucer riddle had been hidden behind a curtain of Air Force secrecy. And now, an assignment from True Magazine on flying saucers. 24 hours later, I was in Ken Purdy's office. I've had men on this for 2 months, he told me. I might as well warn you, it's a tough story to crack. You think it's a Russian missile? I asked him. Or an Air Force secret? We've had several answers. None of them stacks up. But I'm positive one was deliberately planted when they found we were checking. He told me the whole story of the work that had been done by the staff of True and of the reports sent in by competent writers. The deeper he delved into the mystery, the tougher the assignment got. The more I learned about flying saucers, the less I knew. There's one angle I want rechecked, Purdy said. You've heard of the Mantle case? I nodded. Okay, try to get the details of Mantle's radio report to Godman Tower. Before he was killed, he described the thing he was chasing. We know that much. Project Saucer gave out a hint, but they've never released the transcript. Here's another lead. See if you can find anything about a secret picture taken at Harmon Field, Newfoundland. It was around July 1947. I'll send you other ideas as I get them. Before I left, Purdy wished me luck and told me that he would work in closest harmony with me. But watch out for fake tips, he said. You'll probably run into some people at the Pentagon who'll talk to you off the record. That handcuffs a writer. Look out, they don't lead you into a blind alley. Even the Air Force statements and the Project Saucer report contradict each other. For 6 months, I worked with other investigators to solve the mystery of the discs. We checked 100 sighting reports, frequently crossing the trail of Project Saucer teams and FBI agents. Old records gave us fantastic leads. So did Air Force plans for exploring space. Rocket experts, astronomers, Air Force officials and pilots gave us clues pointing to a startling solution. Many intelligent persons, including scientists, believe the saucers contain spies from another planet. When this first phase was ended, we were faced with a hard decision. We had uncovered important facts. We knew the saucers were real. If it was handled carefully, we believed the story would be in line with the secret Air Force policy. It was finally decided to publish certain alternate conclusions. The Air Force was informed of True's intentions. No attempt was made to block publication. In the January 1950 issue of True, I reported that we had reached the following conclusions: the Earth has been observed periodically by visitors from another planet. This observation has increased markedly in the past 2 years. The only other possible explanation, I wrote, is that the saucers are extremely high-speed, long-range devices developed here on Earth. Such an advance, which the Air Force has denied, would require an almost incredible leap in technical progress even for American scientists and designers. Nationwide press and radio comment followed the appearance of the article. This publicity was obviously greater than the Air Force had expected. Within 24 hours, the Pentagon was deluged with telegrams, letters and long-distance calls. Apparently fearing a panic, the Air Force hastily stated that flying saucer reports, even those made by its own pilots and high-ranking officers, were mistakes or were caused by hysteria. Insert 1, Air Force Press Release 629-49, December 27, 1949. But 3 days later, when it was plain that many Americans calmly accepted True's disclosures, the Air Force released a secret Project Saucer file containing this significant statement: "It will never be possible to say with certainty that any individual did not see a spaceship, an enemy missile or other object." In this same document there appears a confidential analysis of Air Intelligence Reports, too. It is this summary that contains the official suggestion of space visitors' motives. After stating that such a civilization would obviously be far ahead of our own, the report adds, insert 2, Air Force Project Saucer Report, December 30, 1949. Since the acts of mankind most easily observed from a distance are A-bomb explosions, we should expect some relation to obtain between the time of the A-bomb explosions, the time at which the spaceships are seen, and the time required for such ships to arrive from and return to home base. In a previous report, which alternately warned and reassured the public, the Air Force stated that space travel outside the solar system is almost a certainty. Insert 3, Air Force Report M2649, Preliminary Studies on Flying Saucers, April 27, 1949. Since 1949 there has been a steady increase in saucer sightings. Most of them have been authentic reports, which Air Force denials cannot disprove. In January, mystery disks were reported over Kentucky, Indiana, Texas, Pennsylvania, and several other states. On the Seattle-Anchorage route, an air freighter was based for 5 minutes by a night flying saucer. When the pilots tried to close in, the strange craft zoomed at terrific speed. Later, the airline head reported that intelligence officers had quizzed the pilots for hours. From their questions, he said, "I could tell they had a good idea of what the saucers are." One officer admitted they did, but he wouldn't say any more. Another peculiar incident occurred at Tucson, Arizona, on February 1. Just at dusk, a weird, fiery object raced westward over the city, astonishing hundreds in the streets below. The Tucson Daily Citizen ran the story next day with a double banner headline, "Flying Saucer Over Tucson? B-29 Fails to Catch Object, Flying Saucer? Secret Experimental Plane? Or Perhaps a Scout Craft from Mars?" Certainly the strange aircraft that blazed a smoke trail over Tucson at dusk last night defies logical explanation. It was as mystifying to experienced pilots as to groundlings who have trouble in identifying conventional planes. Cannonballing through the sky, some 30,000 feet aloft, was a fiery object, shooting westward so fast it was impossible to gain any clear impression of its shape or size. At what must have been top speed, the object spewed out light-colored smoke, but almost directly over Tucson it appeared to hover for a few seconds. The smoke puffed out an angry black and then became lighter as the strange missile appeared to gain speed. The radio operator in the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base Control Tower contacted First Lieutenant Roy L. Jones, taking off for a cross-country flight, in a B-29, and asked him to investigate. Jones revved up his Swift aerial tanker and still the unknown aircraft steadily pulled away toward California. Dr. Edwin F. Carpenter, head of the University of Arizona Department of Astronomy, said he was certain that the object was not a meteor or other natural phenomenon. Switchboards swamped. Switchboards at the Pima County Sheriff's Office and Tucson Police Station were jammed with inquiries. Hundreds saw the object. Tom Bailey, 1411 East 10th Street, thought it was a large airplane on fire. A later check showed no planes missing. He said it wavered from left to right as it passed over the mountains. Bailey also noticed that the craft appeared to slow perceptibly over Tucson. He said the smoke apparently came out in a thin, almost invisible stream, gaining substance within a few seconds. This incident had an odd sequel the following day. Its significance was not lost on the Daily Citizen. It ran another front-page story, headlined, "What Do You Mean Only Vapor Trail?" as though to prove itself blameless for tilting hundreds of Tucson heads skyward. The U.S. Air Force yesterday afternoon spent hours etching vapor trails through the skies over the city. The demonstration proved conclusively to the satisfaction of most that the strange path of dark smoke blazed across the evening sky at dusk Wednesday was no vapor trail and did not emanate from any conventional airplane. The Wednesday night spectacle was entirely dissimilar. Then, heavy smoke boiled and swirled in a broad, dark ribbon fanning out at least a mile in width and stretching across the sky in a straight line. Since there was no proof as to what caused the strange Braddock manifestation, and because even expert witnesses were unable to explain the appearance, the matter remains a subject for interesting speculation. There is strong evidence that this story was deliberately kept off the press wires. The Associated Press and other wire services in Washington had no report. Requests for details by Frank Edwards, Mutual newscaster, and other radio commentator ran into a blank wall. At the Pentagon, I was told that the Air Force had no knowledge of the sighting or the vapor trail maneuvers. On February 22, two similar glowing objects were seen above Boca Chica Naval Air Station at Key West. A plane sent up to investigate was hopelessly outdistanced. It was obvious the things were at a great height. Back at the station, radarmen tracked the objects as they hovered for a moment above Key West. They were found to be at least 50 miles above the Earth. After a few seconds, they accelerated at high speed and streaked out of sight. On the following day, Commander Augusto Orrego, a Chilean naval officer, reported that saucers had flown above his Antarctic base. "During the bright Antarctic night," he said, "we saw flying saucers, one above the other, turning at tremendous speeds. We have photographs to prove what we saw." Early in March, Ken Purdy phoned the latest developments in the investigation. He had just received a tip predicting a flurry of saucer publicity during March. It had come from an important source in Washington. "You know what it probably means," he said. "The same thing we talked about last month. But why were we tipped off in advance?" "It's one more piece in the pattern," I said. "If the tip's on the level, then they're stepping up the program." Within 3 days, reports began to pour in, from Peru, Cuba, Mexico, Turkey, and other parts of the world. Then on March 9, a gleaming metallic disc was sighted over Dayton, Ohio. Observers at Vandalia Airport phoned Wright-Patterson Field. Scores of Air Force pilots and groundmen watched the disc, as fighters raced up in pursuit. The mysterious object streaked vertically skyward, hovered for a while miles above the Earth, and then disappeared. A secret report was rushed to the Civil Aeronautics Authority in Washington, then turned over to Air Force Intelligence. Soon after this, Dr. Craig Hunter, director of a medical supply firm, reported a huge elliptical saucer flying at a low altitude in Pennsylvania. He described it as metallic, with a slotted outer rim and a rotating ring just inside. On top of this sighting, thousands of people at Farmington, New Mexico, watched a large formation of disks above the city. Throughout all these reports, the Air Force refused to admit the existence of flying saucers. On March 18, it flatly denied they were Air Force secret missiles or space exploration devices. 3 days later, a Chicago and Southern airliner crew saw a fast-flying disk near Stuttgart, Arkansas. The circular craft, blinking a strange blue-white light, pulled up in an arc at terrific speed. The two pilots said they glimpsed lighted ports on the lower side as the saucer zoomed above them. The lights had a soft fluorescence, unlike anything they had seen. There was one peculiar angle in the Arkansas incident. There was no apparent attempt to muzzle the two pilots, as in earlier airline cases. Instead, a United Press interview was quickly arranged for nationwide publication. In this wire story, Captain Jack Adams and First Officer C.W. Anderson made two statements: "We firmly believe that the flying saucer we saw over Arkansas was a secret experimental type aircraft, not a visitor from outer space. We know the Air Force has denied there is anything to this flying saucer business, but we're both experienced pilots and we're not easily fooled." The day after this story appeared, I was discussing it with an airline official in Washington. "That's an odd thing," he said. "The Air Force could have persuaded those pilots, or the line president, to hush the thing up. It looks as if they wanted that story broadcast." "You mean the whole thing was planted?" "I won't say that, though it could have been. Probably they did see something, but they might have been told what to say about it." "Any idea why?" He looked at me sharply. "You and Birdie probably know the answer. At a guess, I'd say it might have planned to offset the Navy commander's report, the one on the White Sands sightings." The White Sands case had puzzled many skeptics, because the Pentagon had cleared the published report. The author, Commander R. B. McLaughlin, was a regular Navy officer. As a Navy rocket expert, he had been stationed at the White Sands Rocket Proving Ground in New Mexico. In his published article, he described three disc sightings at White Sands. One of the discs, a huge elliptical craft, was tracked by scientists with precision instruments at 5 miles per second. That's 18,000 miles per hour. It was found to be flying 56 miles above the Earth. Two other discs, smaller types, were watched from 5 observation posts on hills at the Proving Ground, circling at incredible speed. The two disks based an Army high-altitude rocket that had just been launched, then speeded up and swiftly outclimbed the projectile. Commander McLaughlin's report, giving dates and factual details, was cleared by the Department of Defense. So was a later nationwide broadcast. Then the Air Force made its routine denial. Why was McLaughlin, a regular Navy officer subject to security screening, permitted to give out this story? Was it an incredible slip-up? Or was it part of some carefully thought-out plan? I believe it was part of an elaborate program to prepare the American people for a dramatic disclosure. For almost a year, one have watched the behind-the-scenes maneuvers of those who guide this program. In the following chapters, I have tried to show the strange developments in our search for the answer, the carefully misleading tips, the blind alleys we entered, the unexpected assistance, the confidential leads, and the stunning contradictions. It has been a complicated jigsaw puzzle. Only by seeing all parts of this intricate picture can you begin to glimpse the reasons for this stubbornly hidden secret. The official explanation may be imminent. When it is finally revealed, I believe the elaborate preparation, even the wired deceit involved, will be fully justified in the minds of the American people. Chapter 2. It has been over 2 years since the puzzling death of Captain Thomas Mantle. Mantle died mysteriously in the skies south of Fort Knox. But before his radio went silent, he sent a strange message to Godman Air Force Base. The men who heard it will never forget it. It was January 7, 1948. Crowded into the Godman Field Tower, a group of Air Force officers stared up at the afternoon sky. For just an instant, something gleamed through the broken clouds south of the base. High above the field, three P-51 fighters climbed with swift urgency. Heading south, they quickly vanished. The clock in the tower read 2:45. Colonel Guy Hicks, the CO, slowly put down his binoculars. If the thing was still there, the clouds now hid it. All they could do was wait. The first alarm had come from Fort Knox, when Army MPs had relayed a state police warning. A huge gleaming object had been seen in the sky, moving toward Godman Field. Hundreds of startled people had seen it, at Madisonville, 90 miles away. 30 minutes later, it had zoomed up over the base. Colonel Hicks glanced around at the rest of the men in tower. They all had a dazed look. Every man there had seen the thing, as it barreled south of the field. Even through the thin clouds, its intermittent red glow had hinted at some mysterious source of power. Something outside their understanding. It was Woods, the exec, who had estimated its size. Hicks shook his head. That was unbelievable. But something had hung over Godman Field for almost an hour. The CO turned quickly as the loudspeaker, tuned to the P-51s, suddenly came to life. "Captain Mantle to Godman Tower. Mantle to Godman Tower." The flight leader's voice had a strained tone. "I've sighted the thing," he said. "It looks metallic and it's tremendous in size." The CO and Wood stared at each other. No one spoke. "The thing's starting to climb," Mantle said swiftly. "It's at 12 o'clock high, making half my speed. I'll try to close in." "In 5 minutes," Mantle reported again. The strange metallic object had speeded up, was now making 360 or more. At 3:08, Mantle's wingman called in. Both he and the other pilot had seen the weird object. But Mantle had outclimbed them and was lost in the clouds. 7 minutes dragged by. The men in the tower sweated out the silence. Then, at 3:15, Mantle made a hasty contact. "It's still above me, making my speed or better. I'm going up to 20,000 feet. If I'm no closer, I'll abandon chase." It was his last report. Minutes later, his fighter disintegrated with terrific force. The falling wreckage was scattered for thousands of feet. When Mantle failed to answer the tower, one of his pilots began a search. Climbing to 33,000 feet, he flew 100 miles to the south. But the thing that lured Mantle to his death had vanished from the sky. 10 days after Mantle was killed, I learned of a curious sequel to the Godman affair. An AP account in the New York Times had caught my attention. The story, released at Fort Knox, admitted Mantle had died while chasing a flying saucer. Colonel Hicks was quoted as having watched the object, which was still unidentified. But there was no mention of Mantle's radio messages, no hint of the thing's tremendous size. Though I knew the lid was probably on, I went to the Pentagon. When the scare had first broken, in the summer of 47, I had talked with Captain Tom Brown, who was handling saucer inquiries. But by now Brown had been shifted, and no one in the press branch would admit knowing the details of the Mantle saucer chase. "We just don't know the answer," a security officer me. "There's a rumor," I said. "It's a secret Air Force missile that sometimes goes out of control." "Good God, man," he exploded. "If it was, do you think we'd be ordering pilots to chase the things?" "No, and I didn't say I believed it. I waited until he cooled down." "This order you mentioned, is it for all Air Force pilots, or special fighter units?" "I didn't say it was a special order," he answered quickly. "All pilots have routine instructions to report unusual items." They had fighters alerted on the coast, when the scare first broke, I reminded him. "Are those orders still in force?" He shook his head. "No, not that I know of." After a moment he added, "All I can tell you is that the Air Force is still investigating. We honestly don't know the answer." As I went out the mall entrance, I ran into Jack Daly, one of Washington's veteran newsmen. Before the war, Jack and I had done magazine pieces together, usually on Axis espionage and communist activity. I told him I was trying to find the answer to Mantle's death. "You heard anything?" I asked him. "Only what was in the AP story," said Jack. "But 9S man told me they had a saucer story from Columbus, Ohio, And it might have been the same one they saw at Fort Knox. I missed that. What was it? They sighted the thing at the Air Force Field outside of Columbus. It was around sundown, about after that pilot was killed in Kentucky. Anybody chase it? I asked. No. They didn't have time to take off, I guess. This INS guy said it was going like hell. Fast as a jet, anyway. Did he say what it looked like? The Air Force boys said it was as big as a C-47, said Jack. Maybe bigger. It had a reddish-orange exhaust streaming out behind. They could see it for miles. If you hear any more, let me know, I said. Jack promised he would. What do you think they are? He asked me. It's got me stumped. Russia wouldn't be testing missiles over here. Anyway, I can't believe they've got anything like that. And I can't see the Air Force letting pilots get killed to hide something we've got. 1 week later, I heard that a top-secret unit had been set up at Wright Field to investigate all saucer reports. When I called the Pentagon, they admitted this much, and that was all. In the next few months, other flying disc stories hit the front pages. Two Eastern Airline pilots reported a double-decked mystery ship sighted near Montgomery, Alabama. I learned of two other sightings, one over the Pacific Ocean and one in California. The second one, seen through field glasses, was described as rocket-shaped, as large as a B-29. There were also rumors of disks being tracked by radar, but it was almost a year before I confirmed these reports. When Purdy wired me, early in May of 49, I had half forgotten the disks. It had been months since any important sightings had been reported. But his message quickly revived my curiosity. If he thought the subject was hot, I knew he must have reasons. When I walked into his office at 67 West 44th, Purdy stubbed out his cigarette and shook hands. He looked at me through his glasses for a moment. Then he said abruptly, "You know anything about the discs? If you mean what they are, no." He motioned for me to sit down. Then he swiveled his chair around, his shoulders hunched forward, and frowned out the window. "Have you seen the Post this week?" I told him, "Number, there's something damned queer going on. For 15 months, Project Saucer is buttoned up tight. Top secret." Then suddenly, Forrestal gets the Saturday Evening Post to run to articles, brushing the whole thing off. The first piece hits the stands, and then what happens? Purdy swung around, jabbed his finger at a document on his desk. That same day, the Air Force rushes out this Project Saucer report. It admits they haven't identified the disks in any important cases. They say it's still serious enough. Wait a minute. He thumbed through the stapled papers, to require constant vigilance by Project Saucer personnel and the civilian population. "You'd think the Post would make a public kick," I said. "I don't mean it's an out-and-out denial," said Purdy. "It doesn't mention the Post, just contradicts it. In fact, the report contradicts itself. It looks as if they're trying to warn people and yet they're scared to say too much." I looked at the title on the report, "A Digest of Preliminary Studies by the Air Materiel Command, Wright Field, Dayton, Ohio, on Flying Saucers." "Have the papers caught it yet?" I asked Purdy. "You mean it's contradicting the Post?" He shook his head. "No, the Pentagon press release didn't get much space. How many editors would wade through a 6,000-word government report? Even if they did, they'd have to compare it, item for item, with the Post piece." "Who wrote the Post story?" Purdy lit a cigarette and frowned out again at the skyscrapers. "Sidney Shortt, and he's careful. He had Forrestal's backing. The Air Force flew him around, arranged interviews, supposedly gave him inside stuff. He spent 2 months on it. They okayed his script, which practically says the sources are bunk. Then they reneged on it. Maybe some top brass suddenly decided it was the wrong policy to brush it off," I suggested. "Why the quick change?" demanded Purdy. "Let's say they sold the Post on covering up the truth, in the interests of security. It's possible, though I don't believe it, they could simply have fed them a fake story. Either way, why did they rush this contradiction the minute the Post hit the stands?" "Something serious happened," I said, after the post went to press.
Yes, but what?
Purdy said impatiently.
That's what we've got to find out. Does Shawit's first piece mention Mantle's death?